You're listening to the COVID-19 Update, a podcast from the CSIS Global Health Policy Center focused on the science and policy implications of the outbreak. I'm Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm joined by my colleague, Steve Morrison, to discuss the latest on COVID-19.
We're delighted today to be joined by Dr. Margaret Bordeaux. She's the director of the Harvard Medical School Global Public Policy and Social Change Program and also a Harvard Medical School instructor at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She worked previously with the Office of the Secretary of Defense's Policy Shop. She led a joint Harvard-NATO study of international security forces and their efforts to protect and rebuild health systems in conflict-affected states, and has a very interesting project underway we'll be talking about today, which is entitled COVID Academy, focused upon the National Governors Association and local and state jurisdictions. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I want to first start by expressing condolences on my part and that of Andrew Schwartz. Andrew sends his regrets. He can't be with us today for this podcast. We were all very moved by the loss of Paul Farmer. Of course, he's your close colleague and friend. You've been involved with him professionally. You've been a personal friend of his for many, many years. Partners in Health has a close affiliation with Harvard Medical School. Say a little bit about Paul and his legacy and what this means.
Right. Well, you know, it is a devastating loss. So, you know, Dr. Paul Farmer was the chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School, which is the department that houses my program, the program in Global Public Policy and Social Change. You know, I think in reflecting in his loss and in his legacy and kind of what this means, you know, it means a lot to the whole community. But I think for me personally, you know, I always take two things from Paul. One is his admonition to do hard things together. I think he really understood that the problems of the world were very, very difficult. But he also just was a huge believer that progress was possible. But in order to make progress possible, you had to work with others. He'd always, at my annual reviews, he would always say, "Margaret, who are you thinking about this with?" And I really sort of treasure that approach. I think the other thing that he just, his legacy speaks to in every way is just, you know, it doesn't matter the odds. You know, it doesn't matter the odds. How difficult something looks, it must be undertaken and progress can be made. So I'm kind of glad you opened the session with this because, you know, very much the program that I help run, Program on Global Public Policy and Social Change, was really a brainchild that was produced, you know, in conversation with Paul. And really the motivation behind the creation of the program was, you know, our members of the department are all, you know, practitioners, nurses, doctors, you know, public health practitioners involved in health delivery around the world and usually in some very, very difficult, always in very difficult environments, conflict-affected environments, extremely impoverished environments. And what we were finding was that folks who were providing care or health, running health delivery projects in those contexts were often unaware in some cases of the policy context in which they were operating in, and also were often having trouble engaging in policy conversations and policy formulation processes that were shaping the environments where they worked. You know, so for example, in Haiti, where a lot of Paul's work centered originally, you know, the policies of international aid profoundly shapes the health system there and health delivery. So it determines if the government can pay for health services, for example, you know, or if people have to rely on international NGOs for health care. So those policies are very important. You know, you alluded to my work in Afghanistan, Kosovo and Libya, Liberia, also in the context of the NATO study that I helped lead. And that those were examples where the policies of militaries and security coalitions and peace negotiators have very profound implications for healthcare institutions and the possibilities of healthcare protection during acute conflict and health system recovery afterwards. So PGPP, the Program on Global Public Policy, was really to provide pathways from practice to policy so that practitioners could both learn about policies that influence their work and also impact and participate in policy debate with organizations that were typically not health organizations, but were very much impacting their work. So, you know, that was really how we came into, you know, into this work, was trying to build pathways between practice and policy. And then, of course, when COVID happened, we really pivoted, like many, to focusing on COVID response domestically and trying to support, you know, practitioners and providers who were starting to work with local and state public health departments on responding to COVID. And in that process, that's when we started, with the generous support of the MacArthur Foundation, this project called COVID Academy, where we could house and formalize a lot of that work that we were doing, which was very much this pattern of trying to bring practitioners into conversation with policymakers across sectors and institutions.
On Paul, before we talk about the COVID Academy work, which is quite interesting and quite important, Paul Farmer was, seems to me that he was someone who was very brash. He delighted in being provocative and radical in some of, at some points in his thinking. And he brought a normative and ethical perspective that was very much driven by the desire for justice, social justice, equity, empowerment of the disempowered. And of course, the Central Plain in Haiti was kind of the context in which a lot of this thinking took shape. But then it became, you know, his work in Rwanda, his work in Russia. He carried this into many different contexts. His work in, we ran into him in West Africa during the Ebola outbreak. Partners got involved in that part of the world for the first time, really, during Ebola. So he was very much a figure that changed the field, I believe, in a normative and ethical way that's been pretty deeply rooted. And gender was part of this as well in his very oftentimes quite strident, uncompromising, very forceful and deliberate way. He just did not leave anyone in doubt in his conversations, where he stood and what he expected. And that was quite remarkable. Sometimes you had to kind of step back a little bit from the force of this man's passion. The other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, just observing the flow of recent graduates, undergraduates, graduate students, recent students that come through CSIS or come to our programs, his impact generationally is just profound. This man is worshipped by a whole generation of people who read his books, read Tracy Kidder's Mountain Beyond Mountains, saw him come lecture. I mean, he had boundless energy. He was everywhere oftentimes at the same time, giving speeches upon speeches upon speeches. He used his communications skills were really unrivaled in a way.
I think he always made the impossible seem not only possible, but obvious. You know, I think one of the stories he would often tell, and this comes up a lot in everyone's work in public health, is, you know, he characterized it as socialized to scarcity. The idea was that folks would just give up before even trying, because they would just expect there not to be resources available to solve problems. He would always say it takes a year of providing those resources before providers will kind of wake up and be like, oh, actually, I can treat this patient. I can, you know, run this program. I can get cure people of deadly diseases. And, you know, that kind of scarcity to socialization to scarcity theme comes up. I'm finding it coming up all the time in my own head and also in the heads of, I think, policymakers as we do contemplate this issue of what is next for the public health system of the U.S. And, you know, the voice of, well, we'll never have the funding to be able to do this. Oh, well, you know, these poor people, they don't want to get better. That was something you hear all the time in public health. It's just so crazy. People don't want to get better. They are fine being sick. That's the normal for this community. And Paul is saying, what, really? I don't think so. You know, oh, you know, the classic was, well, we can't give, you know, HIV medications to people in Africa because they can't tell time. I mean, just crazy stuff. And it's been such a unbelievable, sort of surreal almost experience to hear some of the very same language being used in the U.S. Well, we can't, you know, people will never wear a mask. They'll never get vaccinated. They'll never blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's been just a wonderful thing for the world to have somebody like Paul saying, you know, yes, we can. And yes, you better.
We're all going to miss him. I'm sure that we're going to see all sorts of endowments and different things that will very, in a very positive way, memorialize what he meant and who he was and, yes. and his impacts.
Well, the wonderful thing about him is that everyone felt like they were Paul's best friend. You know, he just had that way of sort of, you know, of making people feel that they were incredibly important. And I really loved that about him, you know, and he, when he walked into a room, he would look for the person who was over by the side of the wall, you know, who maybe had a language barrier that wasn't participating in conversation. He'd make a beeline for them. The person always, he was on the outside and gave, great to meet you. So wonderful. Give me your number. Here's my, you know, WhatsApp. You know, it just was a really wonderful way of being in the world. Of course, it did require a lot of people around him to keep up with that and also to endure the divided attentions, right, of somebody who, you know, who really was radical in his way that he lived his life. I don't know if you attended his funeral, but, you know, the eulogies that were given at his funeral were just, you know, very profound.
Thank you for taking the time to share all of that. That's very valuable. And I know how dear your friendship was with him and how deep it was. So it's really very timely and very important to hear from you. Thank you. Let's talk about COVID Academy, which of course is, as you pointed out, it's an outgrowth naturally of the spirit and logic that he brought to all of your work and that you bring to your work. As I understand it from talking to you, this is really intended to try to connect with local and state practitioners, public health entities, also to work with the National Governors Association and looking at how to reform the public, as you're calling it, the public health enterprise. Tell us what that means and how you're going about doing this work and what you're learning.
Right. So first of all, I do call it the public health enterprise rather than I try to avoid saying public health system of the United States, because what I've learned through my work on COVID Academy with practitioners is, you know, we don't really have a public health system in the United States, one that would sort of imply centralized governance and authorities that sort of are at the top or hierarchical in nature. In the U.S., we have a devolved public health responsibilities largely to the states. And about two-thirds of the states have devolved their responsibilities for public health down to the localities, county levels, for example. Massachusetts is unusual that we've devolved them down to the town and municipality. So we have 351 local boards of health. And so what we end up with in a crisis like COVID is really a public health coalition of the willing, if you will. It's very hard for us to come up with this sort of national strategy and approach. So yes, COVID Academy was born out of sort of our initial work of working with Partners in Health, the NGO that Paul Farmer, of course, famously started, when they were contracted by the state of Massachusetts to build out the Massachusetts Contact Tracing Collaborative. And this was right at the beginning of the pandemic in the U.S., and they were working very hard to understand in Massachusetts what the public health enterprise was and how it functioned and how they could support it. they went later went on, and we kind of went with them as they tried to support other jurisdictions building out contact tracing. We worked with the National Governors Association and continued to do so originally on things like digital contact tracing and, you know, other COVID response policy issues. And then we later formed a COVID Academy to kind of formalize and house these initiatives. And when I say we, I want to mention not only my program in global public policy and social change colleagues, but also Dr. KJ Sung and Dr. Shefali Oza, who were at Partners in Health and worked closely with us because they were in the field, really working with practitioners and trying to stand up these programs. So, you know, basically through COVID Academy, we started to learn two things. One was that we were being thrown off by the focus back in 2020 by the lack of a federal response. You know, we were really focused on the on getting the federal government to articulate some type of coherent national response to COVID. And it just didn't happen. But we were so focused on that that we were losing sight of another reality, which was how malpositioned our public health enterprise was to respond to COVID. And I want to say malpositioned because a lot of what is talked about is the decrease in funding for public health and the decrease of the workforce and the size of the workforce for public health, which are indeed very problematic. But it's even if we have the funding and the workforce, we haven't positioned the public health enterprise so that it can actually respond to something like COVID and what I believe will be health crises of the future. And malpositioned from an organizational, from a governance, from a data systems perspective. So that malpositioning issue always was leading to these crazy things happening during 2020 and to this day, where we would have, you know, really brilliant public health leaders in academia calling for interventions that we knew because we were working on the ground, we just knew couldn't ever happen. You know, they're calling for, hey, if you just vaccinate 10% of, you know, Indiana, you'll have X fewer deaths in 2 weeks. And we're like, hey, that's a great idea. And your model is fabulous. But it's not going to happen because we don't have the organizational the infrastructure to be able to do that. So that's that kind of understanding the administrative organizational layout of our public health enterprise. And the second thing we were sort of surprised at was how often there was a similarity between some of the dynamics that we would see in conflict-affected states and settings and what was unfolding in the U.S.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So, first I want to just say that what doesn't apply. I think that the idea that the U.S. is so unbelievably divided that no progress is possible, that narrative is overhyped. Okay. And I just want to say for the record, we have achieved tremendous things. Population of the U.S. has done much, much more, adopted many more of the mitigation than that narrative would have you believe. So we're almost at 70% vaccination. Steve, I am the mother of four children. I cannot get my four children to all do something at once. I mean, this, for a country of 330 million people, a 70% vaccination rate, I think is tremendous. I mean, I just think it's tremendous. I would not have expected that. Same thing when you look at mask uptake. You know, it was really actually tremendous. So I just want to say that narrative of division is, I think, overplayed, overstated. But I would also say we're not united either. There is a tremendous amount of anger, frustration, distrust of public health authorities, anger over the galling and glaring disparities of who's had to bear the brunt of suffering from COVID in this country, you know, and in crisis and conflict affected settings, you know, you see that type of anger and distrust magnified to the point of violence, right? So you, especially civil conflict. So, you know, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, they had in the eastern region when they had the Ebola outbreak there, you know, you saw folks attacking health workers, bombing health clinics in some cases, you know, huge anger. You see, you know, the killing of polio vaccinators in Pakistan. You see, you know, in Liberia, the mob that attacked Ebola clinics there. I mean, you know, in these, you know, places, you have, you know, organized violence on the part of the population against a health intervention. So the very first thing that you know to do when you're in those settings is you have to create a lot of cognitive dissonance so that people's experience of the day-to-day health response to a crisis is different than what they are hearing or seeing in mass media or through rumor mills or by exploitative political leaders. You have to go in at the community level and really work with people and get in front of them. And, you know, that's been something which seems very daunting to do, but has been done successfully in these most fraught political situations. So, you know, one thing, I don't know if you remember from some of the Ebola outbreaks, but Doctors Without Borders, folks were very scared to go into their hospitals to get treatment because they were absolutely convinced they would die there or they would be killed there. So, you know, the first thing they always do, MSF does, is when people are discharged from the hospital, they put a big banner outside the hospital where they have people leave their handprint and their name, you know, and so people can see, you know, as they're walking down the street, there are lots of folks that are going into the hospital and are surviving and coming out and are cured. You know, the World Health Organization, again, and the DRC and the Democratic Republic of Congo funded lots of programs to send community health workers, in some cases from Haiti, from Guinea, from other countries that had experience with very distrustful populations. You know, they sent them to go door to door in the DRC to talk to people about the outbreak and the health response. You know, you have to get in front of folks. So creating that cognitive dissonance is really important. And what that means for us in the U.S., and as we contemplate public health system reform or public health enterprise reform, is we know that one of the requirements is going to be the need for programs that have local touches with people that are present in their lives and are adding value in between crises. And, you know, I've been really struck by a lot of public health state leadership talking about the trend to shift the public health departments away from direct service provision. Used to be and still is in many places in the country, you know, public health departments would give your kids vaccines day to day, routine vaccines. They would show up after people had children, babies, you know, and do some postnatal public health visits just to say, you know, hello and help you out with it, with, you know, taking care of the baby when you got home from the hospital. That kind of presence, we took those down because we thought, oh, well, we should just pay a company to do that, or we should pay, you know, medical providers to do that. But what that did was it took away that local connection that we absolutely have to have if we're going to have actual biosecurity. If we're actually going to have to be able to rely on the public health system when there is a crisis. So that's number one lesson from conflict affected settings. That creation of cognitive dissonance is only possible when you have those kind of local connections. The second is that in conflict affected places and communities where trust is just not there, you can't really rely on these blunt mitigation measures where you're asking everybody to get vaccinated, everybody to wear a mask. You just don't have that kind of social cohesion. So what you have to do is be very clever about and specific about how you're going to deploy your mitigation measures. And in order to be clever, you have to have eyes on the ground. You have to understand how a crisis is unfolding, and in this case, how a infectious disease is being transmitted. You have to understand the context. You have to learn from that. You have to iterate on that. And then you have to refine your approaches, right? And, you know, all the great stories of public health had that as their narrative, right? Even if you look at Jon Snow and the Broad Street Pump, the apocryphal story about epidemiologist Jon Snow in 1854, the cholera outbreak in London, he was making an observation, he was figuring out how it applied to a particular community, and then, of course, you know, taking the handle off the Broad Street water pump to stop the epidemic. And that's what we don't have, okay? I mean, that's what our public health enterprise is really lacking. It's lacking the ability to collectively understand how transmission of COVID is happening and iterate a response and have the tools to iterate that response at the local level. So those are the some of the things that we started to learn, and that has led us at COVID Academy and with our partners to really coalesce around a strategy and a framework that we think would be very helpful to focus reform conversations around. And we're calling it the Community Outbreak Investigation and Response Strategy that we think can guide us and help fulfill some of those requirements that I just laid out.
So tell me what that means. Is this is a test, isolate, quarantine, local capacitation? What is it?
So we call it CHOIR for short, so Community Outbreak Investigation and Response. So there's two parts in the title. There's the investigation and there's the response. And as the name also suggests, really it's anchored at the community level. It doesn't mean it has to go through a local public health department, because a lot of states don't have local public health departments, but they have, you know, local presence or local units that are able to undertake this work. So that's under the umbrella of COVID Academy. We've pulled together a roundtable of practitioners of what we're calling CHOIR to really refine, standardize, and build out what this approach is.
Is this meant to generate like a model or format that we've got 3,000 jurisdictions, right, across the country, local public health jurisdictions? Are you trying to come up with something that could be marketed as a tool for all of those jurisdictions in some form?
Yes. So this would be a capability that would be available to all localities in the U.S. You know, I was listening to the head of the de Beaumont Foundation talk, and, you know, him saying it should never be said after COVID that once you've seen one local public health department, you've seen one local health department. You know, so right now we just have tremendous variability in terms of what local health departments or units or, you know, entities, agencies, what they can do and what they should be doing. And often in the past, public health, the public health community writ large has done a very good job of sort of laying out very broad capacities and capabilities that they think all public health departments should have. But they're so broad that they're hard to sell to the folks we have to sell them to, like governors. Right. If you say, well, you need to put money in public health so it has better communications and it has more workers and has better data, you know, the immediate question you get back is like, for what? What do I buy with that? What do I get for that? And sometimes the answer is, well, you know, just public health is everything. Everything's going to get better. And while that may be true, and I'm a true believer in that, folks are having a hard time buying into that vision and what that really buys you. So this idea of a community outbreak investigation and response, a discrete capability that helps you see when something is not going right in your community, whether that's an infectious disease outbreak or otherwise, it allows you have a sentinel capability. Folks on the ground are able to say, hey, something's not right. They have the tools to investigate that, understand the context in which that not right thing is happening. Understand, and then they have the ability to both feed that information up so it can be shared and compiled across the country. And they also have the resources they need to tailor a local response so that bad thing can be addressed in a locally appropriate way. And that's the kind of thing. And let me just say, for the record, lots of local public health departments are already doing that. OK, I mean, they have, you know, in isolation for a lot of different things. I mean, it's not like we're starting from tabula rasa here. We have, you know, some of the most sophisticated public health departments in the world are doing that in some cases with some specific diseases, with some, you know, specific mandates. But it's not it's not built out at the local level. Often it sits at the state level. And it's also not standardized so that everyone has it.
This is all really interesting, fascinating. A couple of reactions. One is there are some very interesting initiatives underway, and I want to, perhaps you can mm-hmm. comment. For instance, like the governor of Indiana took the initiative with Christina Box, the chief health officer there, to start mm-hmm. a governor's commission on public health reform. So here you have a very conservative state dominated by Republicans at the various levels, and pulling together a commission, and Judy Monroe, the head of the CDC Foundation, co-chairing, a former chief health officer in India, co-chairing that with a very well-respected former state legislator, and Susan Brooks, the former congresswoman from Indianapolis, who's a great expert on health security, also a senior advisor to this effort. And they've been going around the state listening to communities, and they've heard a lot. They've got a lot of hot air, a lot of flames thrown at them, and they know they've got to come forward to a angry and hostile legislature to ask them to reinvest and re-up the commitment. And that's, I find that really fascinating that that's happening like that, because the, you know, what we're hearing from many different people is that, yes, there are amazing public health authorities here in the District of Columbia. The public health authority here is LaQuandra Nesbitt's fantastic, and she's done lots of innovative things here in the District of Columbia and deserves a lot of credit. And, you know, Mayor Bowser just won the Democratic primary yesterday. And one of the main reasons she won the primary was her performance during the pandemic. And I found that quite amazing, right? There was a lot of skepticism on other levels, but she got rewarded for the performance of the local District of Columbia's public health authority. So we know that. We know that Harris County in Houston, we know that, you know, you can, Massachusetts has a long tradition of public health ethos and local action, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of authorities around the country are running scared and are in crisis. They're under attack. They were already underfunded and understaffed, but the people are getting attacked as the enemy of freedom, and they're tools of some distant Fauciism, in the words of Governor DeSantis, and they need to be punished, and they need their authorities reduced. And people are saying, enough of this shit. I'm not going to have these people on my front lawn yelling at me, because I want to urge caution in the use of masks, urge people to use masks, or argue for limited mandates and these sorts of things. The whole mandate issue seemed to, in the last year, really drive towards deeper and harsher polarization. And we are a country that turns to violence fairly quickly these days. So that is one thing that where you've had erosion of trust, you've had a radicalization in many communities that threatens public health authorities. And how are we going to cope with this? How are we going to replenish and restore those authorities? Because people are going to, just like electoral officials who've been showing up at these hearings on the Select Committee on January 6th, are recounting how their lives have been turned upside down because they did their jobs.
Now, it is discouraging. This is my observation, is that, and this is why I prefaced with the opener of, we are not as divided as I think we might feel we are if we are listening to those stories. I'm not denying the reality that there is hostility in many cases, even physical confrontation with public health authorities. That is happening. But the countering narrative, I guess what I'd shorthand it is, it just isn't as bad as the DRC, as Democratic Republic of Congo, when you had to go in and stem an Ebola outbreak in a war zone, okay? And I will tell you that the way forward is, in those cases, is you do have to really lean in an engagement. And you have to think very carefully about how that engagement unfolds. And what I would say, and, you know, when you hear these, you know, we run this roundtable, as I said, and every other week we have folks come in and present their outbreak investigation responses. And I mean, Steve, if you just wanted to just renew your faith in the country, I mean, it is just so incredible to listen to these guys. I mean, this is, you know, more than a dozen jurisdictions all over the country, Alaska, Louisiana, Missouri, Nebraska, you know, Nevada, California, Pima County, North Carolina, of course, Massachusetts. I mean, these are very, very geographically diverse and politically diverse folks who come in and tell their story of how they dealt with an outbreak and they're in a community. And how scared, you know, they were to call the business one of my favorite stories was just public, so I can share it, is Louisiana. They don't have any county public health boards. They all run it from the state, but they have, you know, regions. And the head of outbreak investigations, they started collecting information about outbreaks rather than total numbers. And that put them in a position to see that COVID wasn't everywhere. It was actually, most of it was taking place in their fish packing plants. And so they were able to, you know, first they were very scared, you know, to reach out to business owners of these fish packing plants, thinking they were going to be run out of town, et cetera. And in fact, they were so scared that, like, you know, when they called the person who, when the guy picked up, she's like, oh, he's on the phone. Just wait 1 second. And got somebody else to take the call, you know. So, but, you know, of course, when they start explaining why they're there, showing that they really want to do well by them, by their business, by their employees, you know what? The tide turned. Second thing they did, they had a huge outbreak of COVID at a swingers conference in New Orleans. Shocking, right? In the middle of a pandemic, you would have a swingers conference where people would be descending upon your convention center and getting to know one another in all the ways that we can imagine. And they have a huge outbreak. Well, the next year, they're going to plan it again. So the head of this outbreak investigation unit is like, I'm going to call those guys and I'm going to ask if we can't design some protocols with them. And he was like, no way, that's never going to happen. They're never going to take your call. He did. And not only did they say, yes, we will work with you to figure out how to make this the safest swingers conference ever. We will have you give a keynote address. And so he did. And they instituted those protocols and they didn't have an outbreak. I mean, it's when you get people, you go to them in their face, you talk to them one-on-one, you don't set it up so that they're hearing stuff from the media and coming to a public meeting to just voice, you are working the problem with people. That's where the magic happens. And we have to put our public health enterprise in position to be able to have those interactions. Right. And having the ability for local actors to be able to have the resources to investigate either an outbreak or any new health crisis that they're seeing and to be able to layer on responses. This is critical. So what we've done in terms of responses in the countries, we've siloed them all. I understand why we did it, but we have vaccination over here. We have treatment over there. We have testing over there. And so what these outbreak investigators and responders are able to do is to go to, you know, an elder care home that has been completely neglected. They've lost three people in the, you know, to COVID. They can't even get the super to return their call and fix their toilet. Local public health shows up. It's like they're first hostile. We're worried. What is this vaccine? We don't want this. I don't know what you're doing here. Hey, hold on. You've lost three members of your community. Yes, that was very sad. We're very sad about that. Okay, well, let's talk about what's happening here. Okay, can you fix my toilet? That was the first question. Yeah, I can't get the super to return my call. Can you fix my toilet? Yes, I'm going to fix your toilet. And then I'm going to talk to you about vaccination. I'm going to bring the vaccines to you. I'm get a call, 2 a.m. I'm sick. I'm scared I've got COVID. Okay, what's your symptoms? Yes, I think you might have COVID. Let's get you to a doctor that can give you monoclonal antibody treatment immediately. Oh, I don't know how to do that. My doctor doesn't have access to that. I'm going to help you do that. So it's showing up for people at some of the worst moments of their lives. That is what builds bridges. And I know it can happen here. It is happening here because it also happens in places like the DRC. So this is where I'm going to get kind of Paul Farmer on you and tell you, I don't believe that, you know, that Americans can't see reason on this. They just need the relational interaction that fosters trust. And we have to double down on that instead of retreating from it. And what I see is a lot of people psyching themselves out. Oh, we're under attack. Oh my gosh, they're going to kill you. Blah, 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 blah. Forget it. Stop it. Okay? We have to lean in at this moment. And it's not the time to take down the shingle and to run and hide. And I get it that legislators are really hyped up on this. They see this as a political thing that they can make a lot of hay out of. And we do have to turn the volume down, you know, as best we can. But Indiana, come on, you know, Alaska, Florida, even. Florida's putting together their own commission to look at the public health system. So there is willingness there, and we just have to keep at it. And if we don't, we're fools.
That's a powerful argument. And, you know, I, just as an aside, I was at a panel discussion a couple weeks ago with some of my classmates, and the mayor of Dade County, Miami-Dade County, was there speaking, Christine Levine Cava, and the Cy Vance, the former DA in Manhattan, was there talking about cybersecurity. Cava was talking about dealing with crises, climate crises, you know, the collapse of the apartment building. And then there was a woman, Celeste Cento, who's the water czar in California, and talking about the crisis in California around water. What was interesting was when the question was posed about, okay, we are toxically polarized as a country, and we're toxically polarized around these issues of climate change, of cyber, of this world, and these threats, and there are multiple threats that we're dealing with. It's not just pandemic, it's multiple threats that get thrown together. How do you, as a leader, break through this, what it seems like a pretty pathological environment for discussion and debate? And each of them, separately and independently, came back to the argument you're making, which is you have got to slow down, engage locally, and listen to people, and change the tone and direction of the conversation. And that's essential for this. And it's retail, and it's very transactionally, it's quite demanding, but it's important. And that, I think that's true. Two points I want to make. One is Deborah Birx, you know, when she was still working in the White House, but had lost power and was displaced by The Economist and then by Scott Atlas and others, she went on the road for 7 months, two stretches, 7 months on the road, 44 states, 30 universities, 310 daily reports, et cetera, et cetera. And she built that into her book, the Silent Invasion book. And she came on recently to this same podcast. And I think that travel in the midst of this was doing what you're talking about. It was that local engagement times 310, and her revelations around the fragility, the realities of rural health being fundamentally different from urban or suburban health, and that we fail to do this. The problems of data, the problems of staffing, the problems of continuity and the like. And I found that very powerful.
So the thing that I really want to emphasize is, yes, 1,000 times, it's the local engagement. The thing that we have to think about is, what I don't want people to do is hear, oh, we have to have leaders have to be locally engaged. Absolutely. But, you know, we're 330 million people, right? So how do we sort of scale that? And what I'm talking about with public health enterprise reform is we have to think about, how do we design our public health institutions, govern them, resource them, so that they can have those interactions? It's a Alexander Hamilton problem, right? It's a, how do we create institutions that bring people in proximate, having those proximate conversations, those local conversations? And it's not like we're starting from nothing. We do have some semblance of that, okay? But we need to focus it, standardize it, make it excellent. A lot of times there's really difficult, like, little issues with, like, data systems, as you said, or, you know, giving folks, the local folks, access to things like genomic sequencing. You know who's done that? North Carolina. North Carolina is every outbreak they investigate, they do genomic sequencing so they can pinpoint exactly how transmission happened. It's very inspiring. So we can do that, but we have to build the organization to do it. And, you know, before Paul, actually, the real reason I got into this was because I went to Helen Caldicott's lecture when I was 12 years old. Do you know who Helen Caldicott is?
She was the advocate against atomic weapons.
Exactly. And she was, she won the Nobel Prize.
Legendary figure.
Yes. Legendary. And she gave, I was 12. I went to college. College was offering a lecture for, you know, forum for her. And I'll never forget the story she told. She said, she's from Australia. She's a pediatrician. I'm a pediatrician, by the way. And she was a pediatrician, and she said she went around the world trying to convince people, build political support for regulation of nuclear weapons. And she went to Australia, and she was in a very rural community, outback community. I think it was something like the Rotary Club or the Lions Club had hosted her. And they said, do not go on stage and talk to these folks, these rural farmers, about nuclear weapons. First of all, they're just the hawkish, you know, people you can imagine politically. They are just absolutely conservative and red as you can get. They will not listen to a woman pediatrician talking about nuclear war. And she said, well, you know what? I got out of there and I got a standing ovation. And they said, what did you say to the, they were signing up on the dot. They were so down with the program that, you know, she had them all sign up to join the, you know, join the cause. Anyway, she said, well, I really decided I would focus on radiation's impact on the male testicle. And the entire lecture was about that. And I would say, you know, it's a joke, of course, but meeting people where they're at is very, very, very powerful. And I know it in my core that we can make progress. But it really is an organizational issue. Okay, it's making sure that our focus as we go through these big initiatives. I mean, there's several, as you mentioned, the Commonwealth Commission. There's also the that was just announced. There's the potentially the COVID Commission that is going to be funded by the American Prevent Pandemics Act. There is a very important grant that the CDC, it's CCELS, one of the CDC just released on building infrastructure and workforce and public health. An enormous grant paid for out of the American Rescue Funds. You know, those are big vehicles and opportunities for us to re-envision what our public health enterprise should look like. And that's where I think we can start to take the lessons of Indiana, their commission, and actually several other states have done this as well. You know, Nevada, Oregon, North Carolina. I believe Florida has also stood up its own public health commission to look at its public health infrastructure. And of course, the unified public health law effort, which is very important to try to bolster and redefine public health law. Anyway, all of those, you know, the theme that I am hoping will be focused on in all and manifest in all of those initiatives. Oh, the Forecasting Outbreak Center of the CDC. All of those groups, I think, you know, really need to come to the table here and think about what is the experience of the average American in public health, and how can we make that a positive experience, and how can we make the local health presence be maximally effective? And again, I think that one way to do that is by building out this community outbreak investigation and response capability that can help. And the other nice thing about that is that there's a role for everybody. There's a role for the locals, there's a role for states, there's a role for the feds in that process, inquire. That I think, you know, reassures everybody they're not getting cut out. they have valuable contributions to make.
This has been a great conversation, and thank you. Before we run out of time, we ask each person comes on to sort of close with a thought on what gives you the greatest strength and optimism looking ahead. I think you've given us already plenty of answers to that question, but I'm going to ask you that question anyway, just to sort of close out, because we ask everyone. What is it? What is it that gets you feeling the greatest optimism and strength?
Well, yes, and I'll give you the same answer. I mean, it's, you know, really coming to these roundtables, working with these practitioners in the field, day in, day out, showing up for their communities when the chips are down and, you know, not running away, figuring it out, working the problem. I love the movie Apollo 13. And, you know, when the head of NASA overhears one of the operators talking about the, you know, failed spacecraft that's in trouble, saying, this is going to be our darkest hour. And, you know, the head of NASA says, no, it is going to be our finest hour. And when I'm listening to these practitioners, I feel that, you know, and I feel so blessed and lucky to live in the same country as these folks. I'm like, they're amazing. And I want to do well by them. And I want Harvard and I want our federal government and our leading agencies to do well by them. So that's what inspires me.
Well, thank you. This has been a great conversation, and I hope we can reconnect again in another 6 months and find out more about what's happening.
Coronavirus Crisis Update is produced by Laurel Vibazon and managed by Claire Dannenbaum. You can find our full catalog of podcasts, including Pandemic Planet and AIDS Existential Moment, on our homepage at csis.org/podcasts.